Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Under the Radar SFF Books Podcast. I'm your host, Blaze, as always. Thank you so much for joining me and listening wherever you may be around the world. And it's time for another author interview. I'm really excited to have Daniel T. Jackson on my podcast, the author of the Illborn Saga, and one of the best epic fantasy series I've ever read. And hopefully the rest of the series just is right up there with the first two in the series. So Daniel, welcome to the program. Thank you so much for joining me.
Hello, and thank you for inviting me. I'm glad to be here.
Excellent. So, Illborn Saga, I first read it when it was part of the Spiffbow number 7 entry. I believe that was 2 years ago. And it just captured me immediately from almost the actually the prologue, that awesome and brutal prologue, which we'll discuss later in this episode. And one I consider in very high regard. Could you tell us how was your experience in the Spiffbow competition? How was the feedback and how has the saga grown since then?
It's an interesting one because I think it's a fantastic competition. I mean, it's obviously it's a benchmark for so many authors who are self-published in fantasy every year. I think what Mark Lawrence does is fantastic in that competition, and the fact that so many reviewers give up their time is great. But for me personally, I don't perceive it as a major milestone in the progression of the book because I didn't make it to the final with Illborn, and I didn't actually pick up that many new readers as a result of the competition. I think other events have been far more significant across interacting with people on Instagram, Twitter, booktubers picking up the book in taking it on. And relative to those, it's a fantastic competition, but it's not something that I perceive had a big impact on Illborn taking off. And I do keep track of when people add, you know, the book on Goodreads, etc. is for me the best metric of how much attention the book is having at a point in time. And Spiffbow didn't actually have that great an impact compared to some other events in that year.
Well, I thought Illborn should have been in the finals for that. And I was a judge on one of those blog sites. So I always hold in high regard, even though it didn't do what I hoped it would necessarily. So take us back. How did you first want to become a writer? And after you did become a writer, what were your major influences along the way in terms of authors or maybe series that you read over the years?
So I go right back to when I was growing up, I wanted to be a writer. So if somebody asked me throughout my school years, what are you going to be when you're older? It's I'm going to be a writer and I'm going to be a fantasy writer. And I sat down and wrote my first book at the age of 16 on an old typewriter, which was pretty poor quality, but I did still send it off and try and get it published. I failed. And then life took over after that, so I ended up taking a very sensible business type degree, got a sensible career, got married with children, and went off into a career where I was a business owner for a very long time, and I would still write in my spare time, and I would write for fun, I would write for my children, but I would never dream of sitting down to write a novel. But I was always still telling people, some point in the future, I'm going to write a fantasy novel and I'm going to publish it. And it was some people would nod and say, yeah, there he goes again. He's been saying it for 20 years now. But I always knew that was in me that I wanted to do. And then I got an opportunity in 2018. I was able to significantly reduce my time in my day job. And one of the first things I did after I had a couple of months off from that was sit down and start writing Illborn, which had been in my head for years before then. And so it was a fruition of something I'd intended to do all my life, and I just never had the time or personal commitment to do it prior to then. And it's been great to see the finished product go out into the world and be quite well received. A kind of vindication of myself, thinking for so many years, you know what, I think I can do this. And I know I've talked about it for a long time, but I actually think I can do this and do it well.
Awesome. And when you were reading up, you said you wanted to be a writer your whole life. What novels really grabbed you or series when you were younger that made you just want to jump into being a writer?
Oh, there's loads of stuff. So, I mean, I started going right back. I started on fighting fantasy novels and the Lone Wolf series by Joe Deva. And then as I got older, my brother was older than me, introduced me to a load of series. So things like the Shannara Chronicle, the Rift War Cycle, Thomas Covenant Chronicles, obviously Lord of the Rings. And then as I developed as a teenager, my own taste, then like series I loved were things like Memory, Sorrow and Thorn by Tad Williams. I got into Wheel of Time and then were reading those books as they came out in hardback for the next 20 years. Loved the Dragonlance Chronicles, Forgotten Realms, things like that. And then later, A Song of Ice and Fire came out. And that for me was is the first three books of that are still the pinnacle of fantasy writing as far as I'm concerned. And then more recently, I think Melazan is an awesome series, which again is one that you look at and aspire to say, well, I hope to write something that is even, you know, touching the feet of a series like that. I've always been a lifelong fantasy fan. And throughout that time, I've always been conscious of my own perception of which of the books I love, which are the ones I don't love so much, and which are the kind of writing styles that I like and admire. I've tried to take some of that on board over that period.
Awesome. Those are some amazing series. And I say this in all sincerity. I believe your series, when it's all said and done, will be on that same level playing field. I feel strongly, very strongly about that, especially Illborn. It just, everything in this book, I think, is just perfection. And hopefully the listeners will pick it up and we'll get to see what we're talking about here. So Illborn, the whole book, actually the series, it's basically a holy war is taking place in the lands, and our four main characters are in the center of it, or they're being affected by it in some fashion or manner. Yeah. The themes of religion, very heavily influenced, faith, war, love, power, they're all at the forefront. So when you were sitting and writing down Illborn, what messages did you want to curtail to the reader, and what did you want them to feel when they finished Illborn?
Okay, well, I'm always conscious in answering some of these questions that I don't want to get into spoiler territory, if that's okay, because there are lots of elements in the book that I think are best discovered when and where I wanted them to be discovered in the book. But essentially what I wanted to do in Write Illborn was to create a story which I think is intended more for, say, a more mature adult fantasy audience, probably certainly 15 plus, of people who are interested in more mature themes in books. And it was to create a story that was sweeping in scope, I would describe as epic, which are the books I love, which captures a lot of factors in that of conflict around military issues, political, religious, as you stated, but then lots of human emotions as well around love, lust, devastation, grief, etc. And I wanted to touch on those kind of emotions and create a series which were at a high level, had these sweeping events going on of a holy war, of a religious conflict, but at a lower level had human relationships and how people were affected by it. And in terms of the factors I brought into the story, there is conflict in the story because I think conflict is a great way to bring out character. And that, again, that's got both conflict at a macro level, which creates events that the characters are forced to go through, but also at a personal level of putting those characters into difficult situations, making them face adversity and seeing how they react to that adversity or those situations based on the nature of the individual they are, which again helps to tell a story of how characters change over time when you put them under those kind of pressures. So it's a very long-winded answer to your question, but I was trying to create some, I love books that are epic in scope, that I love historical fiction, I love fantasy that has diverse casts of characters set across multiple locations with lots of events happening. And that's what I wanted to create, a story that I love to read. And that was sort of my prime motivation in Illborn. I'd had this idea, there is an elevator pitch, which, if I was to put it in one sentence, I can't do on here because it would spoil the story. But if I go back to my original elevator pitch idea for myself, it was something that I thought had never been done before, what I was setting out to do. It's becoming more apparent by the end of book two what that is. And I think your review of book two, you know, picked up on that towards the end of the review. And it's that story that I wanted to build all the other parts around.
Amazing. Thank you for that answer. And before we get into the four main characters and the prophecy around it, spoiler free, but we have to talk about that prologue, because that prologue just absolutely grabs you. I think it's perfection, and it's also very emotional, to say the least. Could you just, not spoilers, obviously, but you can just go into the construction of that prologue and how you wanted it to just have like the gut punch that it did on the audience and the readership, and make them want to read the rest of it.
Okay. Well, if I say it coming right from this point of view, there's a very common and familiar approach in traditional fantasy of some wise old character turns up in some remote location and they find somebody there. And often in those situations, you know, that character is a mentor type character, or that's the type of role. And I wanted to take that typical expectation and subvert it by creating uncertainty, creating a level of fear in the characters and in the reader as that is going on, as to what is going on here. It was really important to have something of significance at the front of the book, because the main story has four points of view. So I had to I had to create something that, and those four points of view are they're geographically spread out, the characters. They have little seeming connection at the start of the story. So I wanted to give the reader something at the outset that said there's something more going on here, then I'm going to find out of four people who are suddenly thrust into different events when the main story starts. I hope that answers your question to some extent without getting into spoiler territory.
Yeah, if we get into spoilers, that'll just ruin a whole bunch of stuff for the viewers. But I will say that prologue scene is expanded upon throughout the sequel, Aedul's Sin, which I thought was brilliant the way you did that, but that's a discussion for another time. So let's discuss our four main characters. But before that, all four characters, as you said, they're separate on the map geographically. They're in different sections, and they have different goals, and they have different, let's call them, quote unquote, things to deal with. But the thing that connects them is they all experience this dream, this quote unquote prophecy. And yeah. If you have the cover of Aedul's Sin, basically shows what the dream is. It's a gate on a mountain. There's a figure in the middle of the gate. And at the end of the dream, he points the finger at them, the person who is dreaming, and then they wake up. But the effects of that dream, each one is three different words that they hear in their head. Now, we're not going to get into what those words are, because that's also spoilers, but it has different effects on them as you go. So can you talk to me about that, the dream prophecy, how you constructed it, and what did you want to show in the story?
Yeah, it comes back to when I created the story, I always created it in my own mind as a full arc across four books. So I wasn't writing Illborn as one book, getting to the end of it and then thinking, what do I do next? Where do I go from here? So it was. I always had in my head that this was going to be an extended story that will probably be 2,500 to 3,000 pages long to tell the whole tale, and there are going to be things in the story that are there to. You want to reward readers who invest time in your story by giving them trailing things that come ahead of them, and giving them a sense of something greater than they're seeing on the page they're reading at that particular time, in the hope and promise that there will be a payoff for that at some point throughout the series and throughout the story. So there are things introduced early in the book and in the story that there will be payoffs much later in the series, and there's always intended to be. That dream is there to... It's a difficult one because, again, I want people to find things out in the books the way I tell them and when I tell them. But that dream links those four characters and the things they see in that dream link those four characters. How they link them the first time, when the reader's introduced to it, that is not told to the reader. It's something they will find out from investing their time in the book and in the series. But it's something that links these four characters who otherwise you would just say, "What? Why are these? Who are these people? And why am I reading about the four of them separately?" This thing happens to all of them. It happens to them at a similar point in time in their life, and they don't understand what it means, why it's happening to them, and indeed, at the very outset, they don't even remember it properly when waking up. But it is this thread that connects the four of them, which is the first thread that they will start to pull at as the story goes on, that might find other ways in which they're linked together.
Wonderful. And just to sidestep, just one thing you brought up, you said Illborn, a four book series. Is that confirmed that it's going to be a four book series?
Yeah, it's always been a four book series. Yeah. So, awesome. And the two books, the final two books should be of a similar length to the first two.
Amazing. Can't wait to get them. So let's talk about our four main characters. And I think we should do that in one by one and talk about them. So the first one we're introduced is Alana. She witnesses her mother's death. Her mother was a prostitute. And while she's figuring out what to do, who she should reach out for help, she reaches out for help from this one person. And then things happen, let's just say the least. And she's forced to flee. Alana, when I first read her, I grew attached to her from the get-go because she's dealing with a lot of loss and pain, and she's essentially lost and she doesn't know what to do. Talk to us about Alana, the original construction of her, and how you wanted to write her.
Yeah, well, she starts off and she's a troubled character who has. With the childhood she'd had of having a mother as a prostitute, she immediately faces a lot of adversity, and she's forced into some awful situations from the very outset of the book. In terms of what happens from there, the challenges she faces with the justification of saving herself, she does some things which you could regard as, well, certainly self-interested and possibly despicable. Depending on your outlook on them, and Alana's probably been the most controversial character in terms of it's some of the things that she does in the book have offended some people quite a lot, and have had probably most of the 1 and 2 star reviews I've had on the book are as a result of the actions of Alana. But you know, she raises questions for me of, just because you have powers doesn't mean that, you know, you will behave in a way where you are either inherently good or inherently bad. Sometimes you will behave in a way which is, you will do what you have to do in a given set of circumstances. So she's a very interesting character to write from that point of view. And I guess one question she raises is, you know, how far is it reasonable for somebody to go in the interests of self-preservation? And the answer to that question in the book, as I said, some people think she's a brilliant character, others would burn the book as a result of her being in it. So she's certainly an interesting character. And as an author, what you want to do is write interesting characters. It doesn't mean you endorse their actions or endorse anything that they do or would do if they were in the real world, but they're not. They're a fictional character. But yeah, she's certainly a very interesting one to write.
And I definitely know the scenes where some of those 1 or 2 star reviews would write, but we'll talk about that another time. The next one, I think is more of a fan favorite, Liana. So she, at the beginning of the story, she's destined to be married. She has her life pretty much set in front of her, but she's also faithful to the Holy Church. She's probably the most religious of the four, I would say. And then she decides that she doesn't want the life set out for her, and that she decides to join the Holy Church and take her vows. Can you talk to us about Liana and how she came to be? Because she's one of my favorites in the story.
Yeah, and part of it, I enjoyed the contrast between the characters. But yeah, Lyanna has a very different background to Alana. She's come from a middle class family, which is very pious, very religious. She's grown up in a religious school, and she's very devout. And her faith in the teachings of her religion is complete. She's a devout believer. She's probably the most moral of the four characters, and you know, slash good of the four characters. She's also probably the most naive at the start of the book, and you know, part of the questions and development for her is to how does that naivety change over time, and how does her complete faith in her religion change over time? As she's been surrounded all her life by very good people within that religion, and will she encounter people who are less so as events progress in the novel?
I just loved reading about her, and especially the twist that you bring her way. Spoiler free, don't worry. She's one of the fun ones to watch and to read. The next one, this is Arian. He is the son of a duke. He's very regal, very royal. Very well-mannered upper class. He is the third son of the Duke, and tradition dictates that he becomes a priest, but that's not what he wants to be. He wants to be on the front lines. He wants to be a soldier. And then due to his brother's choices, he ends up being trained in the army, and he's on the front lines. This is the one where if you like training and you like battles, this is the character to follow. And some of his scenes were very fun to read and also very brutal and gory, to say the least. So talk to us about Arian and his character.
Yeah, Arian, I guess, is to some extent probably the most traditional of the four characters from a sort of traditional fantasy point of view, in that he's the older teenage alpha male who wants to be a hero, wants to save the world, wants to experience glory. As you said, he rejects the path that his parents are setting out for him. He's the only one of the four characters who's part of the nobility, but he is part of the nobility, and that involves him meeting people who have more influence in, again, the macro events that are taking place in his country. And he happens to find himself in a geographical location which is right at the front end of the events that are going to take place, and putting them on the front line. So he's a character. He's probably of the four characters, he's the most impulsive and the most prone to act before thinking. But his intentions are good. They're not always as well thought through as they might be.
That's true. And the final one, who this is my personal favorite, and I hope he's a favorite of a lot of other readers as well, is Corin. So Corin, he's more isolated on the map geographically than the other three main characters. He's a member of the Aneth tribe, and he's with his love Agbeth with him. And during a raid, because they raid other tribes, he has the option to kill like a mother and child, but he can't do it. And because of that, he gets exiled. And Agbeth goes with him into exile. And the further north they go, the further trouble they get in. And then he has a revelation. I'll just end it there, just to not get into spoiler territory. Corin, from the beginning, it just grabbed me. And I just loved reading every chapter from him. I was just hoping I could get to the next chapter for him, but I enjoyed all the characters as well. Talk to us about Corin and how he came to be.
Again, touching on that point of contrast, whereas Arian is your alpha male, swarthy hero type, Corin is more of your underdog. He's grown up in a warrior-like society where he's physically the weakest male there. At the outset, there is a question of is he a coward? And the choice he makes that you referred to, what he decides to do or not to do, does that define who he is? And he's one where, you know, his nature is different to that of the people around him. And the only person who shares his nature is Agbeth, who's been his lifelong friend in the village. And he appeals to people, I think, because he is this underdog. And in terms of where the story takes him from those initial moments, it's quite dramatic what happens to him as it goes on. And I think his story resonates with a lot of people because of where he starts and where he goes to.
Yeah, he has the quote unquote, he has like a lot of themes and a lot of tropes that you see in like a kind of like a typical epic fantasy story, which is, I guess, grabs a lot of readers, and myself, self included. I'm actually curious, over the years when you get feedback from like reviews and from readers, how would the four of them rank in terms of popularity? I'm just curious here.
In some ways, if it's okay with you, I know the answer to that, but I'm probably not going to say. I'll talk about one poll because this was a poll conducted on Instagram by somebody, and when that poll was taken, it was just asking the question of who's your favourite character, not who is your least favourite character. So who's your favourite character? And Corin was top of that, and then Alana was second, interestingly. But that was done after Illborn had been written, before Age of Sin came out. And you know, I think some of the events in Age of Sin that could impact that ranking. I don't know. I specifically at the outset set out to write four stories where I wanted to create four characters who I perceived as equally interesting in different ways, and to give those characters equal airtime and stories that I hoped that the readers would find equally interesting. So if I take it away from likability to interesting, I've tried to make them as close as I can, so from a reader point of view, if someone reads the book and said, who is the main character, and who is the character I like the most, they wouldn't know. And you know, I think that's really important to me.
Awesome. Let's talk about the in Illborn. You have three interlude chapters, and those were a lot of fun to write. The only bad thing about it is that there was only three, and they were so far apart that you had to read like 250 pages to get to them. And they revolve around a boy. We're not going to get into more than that, and we're going about his journey with his friends trying to get to a certain place. Could you just talk to us a little bit about the interludes, how they were constructed, and how and why you wanted to input them this way, kind of like spaced out between parts, as opposed to like in an intro or like a prologue?
So we talked about the prologue, and I had a very clear objective for the prologue. And then the thing about the interludes is they are set at a different time. And that's, you know, as you read the book, every chapter starts with a date on it or a year on it. And it's immediately apparent as you get to those interludes that they're set well out of the time of the main story. And I'm telling a story, my style is every chapter belongs to a point of view character, similar to A Song of Ice and Fire, if people have read that. But I wanted a way to impart other parts of the story without breaking out of that cycle of POV characters, and the interludes and the prologues and the epilogues allow me to do that. So that the interludes introduce the time period and a set of events, which by the fact they're in the book, people will know they must have some kind of connection to the main story. And again, it comes back to that point of rewarding the reader who persists with the story, that the further you go across the two books with it, prologues, interludes and epilogues, the more apparent it will become as to what that connection is. And that will apply throughout the four book series.
Awesome. And it's clear with the Illborn saga that that the Holy Wars, the Crusades, was a major influence on this the series. How much research did you do into like the Crusades and how much like the Holy Wars, and how much of it is impacted into this series? I don't want to ask.
I love reading factual history novels. I always have, as well as reading my favorite genres of fantasy and historical fiction. And it's clear to anyone who reads the book that I take a lot of things out of the real world and repurpose them for the purposes of the story, not to tell the same story as in the real world, but just some of the events that have happened in history are so fantastic that they're great for inspiration. And certainly in the real world, I remember reading an awesome book, I think it was by Thomas Asbridge, about the Crusades, that you could not make up some of the things that happened across the various Crusades that happened in the Middle Ages that gives such good inspiration for storytelling. And it's a part of the story in the first book. It's something that's happening on a different continent, but the religious struggles in the book, the nature of the church, I mean, people have referenced similarities to Catholicism in the major religion, and my family is Catholic, so it's something that I understand well and write about what you know. And so for me, I want to tell an interesting, riveting story, and by having some of those real-world parallels, it gives familiarities with people. It allows them to recognise certain of the conflicts that happen in the story without me having to write 30 pages to give background of again, the wise person sitting in a pub giving 30 years of history to the people around them chapter that you often get in fantasy books. That's not necessary because... for instance, I talk about a church in the book. People know what a church looks like. I don't then have to describe in detail what a church looks like. Whereas if I use the word temple, that evokes a completely different set of images of what that might look like. I hope, again, another very long-winded answer, but I hope you get where I'm coming from there.
No, of course. I don't mind the long-winded answers at all. I find them more interesting. Just a few more questions here. Of the four main characters, not which one is your favorite, which one of them was the easiest and most smoothest to write, and I guess which one was like the most difficult in terms of like getting your thoughts onto the page and getting it on paper?
I'm driven less by more the type of writing I'm doing. I find some easier than some these parts easier than others rather than the characters. I might write a sort of 2-3 chapter block at a time for a particular character. So I get myself in that mindset. I get myself into the mindset of how do they think? How do they interact with people? How do they make decisions? And then I write it, and it's different for the four, but I don't have a view that any of them are particularly easier or harder than others. Certainly for my writing, it's more about I love writing scenes with dialogue. I love writing scenes with action. And I take ages to write things that involve description. So that's when I notice. So if I know I've got to write a passage that involves lots of description to set up a scene, then I know for me that then becomes that is going to be a hard morning or hard day of writing. If I'm writing dialogue, I love that, just that flows so quickly, and action scenes, that flows really quickly. But comparing characters, I genuinely don't have one that differs. It's just they're just different mindsets for each that put on the shoes of that character, get into their head again and start writing again and keep asking the question, would they do this? How would they react to this? What would they do in these circumstances? And try and be honest to the character as you're doing it.
And while we're talking about your writing process, are you more along the lines of a plotter or a pantser? Do you have like the whole outline on paper or in your head and you're just writing it, or do you have like certain scenes that you know that are going to happen and you're writing your characters towards it? You talk to a little bit about your writing process.
I'm definitely on the plotter side of the scale. I'm not a complete plotter, but when I sat down to write the first book, I had a detailed map for that book and a map for the whole series as well. And with each book, as I've sat down, I've got a map for the book that I then make more detailed for the part of the book that I'm writing as I go, and then get to a point before I'm writing chapters, I have a very detailed bullet point plan of what will happen in this chapter, what are the scenes, what are the key decisions, you know, where do I want to end, what are the conflicts, where do I want to end the chapter, etc. Now, I am flexible. I'm not rigid. So if I'm writing, I see that something doesn't feel right for me, or I see a way to do something better. If I kind of explain it from the point of view of going up a mountain and having camps that you know you've got to get to those points on the mountain, almost like you said, the key scenes. If I do think of a way, actually, I could get there more successfully by doing this rather than that, I'm willing to adapt, but largely I'm working to a plan, because that plan gets me across the arc of the four books to where I want to be at the very end of that period of time. So if there was a scale, I'm well past the halfway point towards the plotter end.
Awesome. And just the final question I have to ask. So after the completion of book two, Age Will Sin, everyone I'm sure is probably asking, you know, how's book three coming along? How's you progressing in it? So, and do you have a title for it? So I'm going to ask you officially, how is book three coming along, and how's your progress?
So it's coming along well. I've written about 115,000 words so far on book three, but I spend quite a lot on time. My first draft, I'm a bit unusual in that I edit every chapter after I've written it. So my first draft, those words have effectively been through two rounds of edits already. I'm taking the month off in August, and then going to sit down again and carry on writing in earnest in September. I've got a working title, but I don't want to share that at this point. If that's okay, because it's no worries. I'm not settled on it, and I also don't want at this point to be offering dates to say the book will be finished by and published by this date. I did that for book two, and I felt like I was putting myself under unnecessary pressure. I want to sit down and write because I love writing the story. I don't want to be feeling that I've got a deadline. I see some of the younger writers in the industry can much more prolific than I am. And I'm quite a slow, steady, meticulous writer, and the book will get written when it's written, and it will be ready when it's ready, and I won't publish it until I think it is as good as it can be. But I'm working hard on it. I've been working hard on it all year, and I'll continue to do so for the rest of this year and into early next year.
Can't wait when that's ready to go. So Daniel, this has been a lot of fun, and thank you so much again for joining me. Could you tell our audience members and listeners where they could find you, your social media handles, and your website, and where they can find your books?
Okay, well, so I've got a link tree, which is Daniel T. Jackson. So on that one, you can find links to everything else, including where the books can be bought. I'm most active on social media on Instagram under Daniel T. Jackson _ Ilborn, and on Twitter on Daniel T. Ilborn. And I'm very interactive with potential readers and actual readers on both of those. So if you contact me on there, message me on there, I'll usually respond very quickly. My books are available pretty much everywhere on online bookstores, obviously Amazon, the Broken Binding store, signed copies of my books. I'm available in the UK and Europe. Lots of bookstores are stocking me now. So most places, physical bookstores as well, should be able to order my books, but certainly I should be available. It should be available on most online retailers.
Lovely. Well, Daniel, again, thank you from the bottom of my heart for joining me. This has been a lot of fun, and hopefully I can have you back on when the series is completed and we can do an in-depth discussion.
Okay. Thanks very much for having me, Blaise. It's really appreciated. And thank you. Thank you for all of your support for the books. That is really appreciated. Thank you.
You're welcome. And cheers, everybody.